This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 9th, 2019. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Headlines from the Pacific Rim and Pacific Northwest. The Big Deal feature. BC Greens leader Andrew Weaver reflects on the bizarre end of the spring session of the BC legislature. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or will China's Communist Party ever take responsibility and make amends for the crackdown on peaceful protesters on June 4, 1989? Students and workers across China in the spring of 1989 call for democracy, free speech, and an end to corruption. But the protest in Beijing between the Forbidden City and the mausoleum where Chairman Mao's body is on display was seen by the world. 10,000 people could have died. We just don't know, because the Communist Party is not interested in truth or reconciliation. The Vancouver Society in Support of Democratic Movement held a protest outside the Chinese consulate on June 4th to commemorate 30 years since the Tiananmen Square massacre. They gathered outside the Granville Street mansion under the gaze of different sizes and shapes of surveillance cameras. I could only wonder, were they watching in Beijing? They chanted in English, and they chanted in Cantonese. They listened to music. They even danced. There was sadness. There was anger. There was also concern that Hong Kong's rule of law and free speech is under attack by Beijing. They also expressed concern for the concentration camps in Xinjiang, where a million Uyghur Muslims are being brainwashed. The driveway was blocked and the candles were gathered and stuck in holders at the end of the vigil. What has changed in 30 years? Shaughnessy mansions have been bought up with Chinese money. One, just a short walk away on Matthews, is in the name of the husband of Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou. She lives there under curfew, under watch of private security guards ordered by the court to make sure she does not flee while the United States applies for her extradition. She lives in luxury, while the human rights of Canadian prisoners Michael Spavor and Michael Kovrig are trampled upon in China. The parade of luxury cars, some from Shaughnessy, many from Richmond. Even a pink Maserati drove by the consulate, directly or indirectly bought with Chinese money. Most went by without slowing down, without honking a horn in support. Speaking of support, there were no municipal, provincial, or federal politicians there. One protester did read aloud a letter of support from NDP MP Jenny Kwan. China's Communist Party is the biggest threat to world stability and human rights since the Soviet Union. Some would say since the Nazis. We cannot forget what happened in 1989, and we cannot ignore what is happening in 2019. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the South China Morning Post, Laura Zhao reports, Russia ready to fill China's food gap left by U.S. in trade war fallout. Hopes that China would buy more pork, soybean, and other protein products from the U.S. were dashed last month after trade negotiations with the Trump administration fell apart. Beijing included pork and chicken on a list of retaliatory tariffs on $60 billion worth of American products in May, and China has also reportedly suspended its soybean imports from the U.S. since then. As the world's biggest producer and consumer of pork, China has been turning to other types of protein, both locally produced and imported, after a devastating outbreak of African swine fever, which began in August last year. China and Russia have been seeking to increase trade in agricultural products over the last few years. Last year, trade between the two countries in agricultural products and food rose by nearly 30% to $5.23 billion, still less than 5% of the overall trade in 2018, which reached to a milestone of $108 billion U.S. In the Star Online, Hemanen Thani Sivanandam reports, Defense Ministry, U.S. government paid for drones. The Malaysian government is not incurring any cost in the acquisition of 12 surveillance drones worth almost $19.3 million from the United States Marine Security Initiative program. Malaysia says it needs the intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance abilities to monitor the Straits of Malacca, the South China Sea, and the Sulu Sea. Boeing is also selling drones to Indonesia, Philippines, and Vietnam amid rising tensions with China. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Steve Dewin reports, Facebook's new Oregon Coast venture angers neighbors left in the dark. Last October, a subsidiary of Facebook bought an undeveloped beachfront lot from former University of Oregon quarterback Joey Harrington for $495,000. The $140 billion company then submitted applications to Tillamook County and the state to use that residential-zoned property as the eastern terminus for one of its transoceanic fiber optic cables. If the conditional use permit is approved, Facebook says it will have drilling equipment in Tierra del Mar for up to 34 days. And unfortunately for Tierra del Mar, permitting for these submarine cables is cake in Oregon compared to California. In the Bellingham Herald, Robert Mittendorf reports, in Washington state, stronger regulation has led to fewer pipeline problems. The June 10, 1999, Olympic pipeline explosion killed three people in Whatcom Falls Park. The tragedy scarred Bellingham. From 1999 through 2018, there were more than 5,700 significant pipeline incidents across the U.S. as defined by the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the main federal regulatory agency. Almost 300 people have died and nearly 1,300 people injured, while property damage has totaled $9.2 billion since 1999. In Washington, new pipeline safety inspection laws were passed, plus pipeline safety promotion since 2000. There have been 9 serious incidents and 1 fatality, a total of $62 million in property damage. And these headlines last week in the Breaker.News. Huawei CFO Meng Wanzhou's extradition hearing to be a drama in 3 acts next year. Credibility of college admissions scheme ringleader Rick Singer is a key issue, says David Sidhu's lawyer. And PNPU mascots will humanize Metro Vancouver, according to regional government bureaucrat. Read the stories behind those headlines in the Breaker.News. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. This week's guest is Andrew Weaver, the leader of the BC Greens and the member of the legislature for Oak Bay Gordon Head. The most prolific blogger in the legislature on andrewweavermla.ca, you can find his latest commentary. It's titled From the Sublime to the Ridiculous, BC Liberals in a Tizzy on the Last Day of the Legislature. On that, Weaver recounts the last hours of the spring session on May 30th, in which the BC Liberal opposition tried again to overthrow Speaker Darrell Plekis. Plekis was doing his job to guard information on hard drives after documents and data had gone missing in recent months, while police are investigating corruption in the legislature.
Well, we didn't know what was going to happen next, because it was a surprise at every turn. You know, the day started, of course, with things going as usual, and then Mr. Wilkinson decided that his party would boycott member statements. These are 2-minute statements, so MLAs on our side had to scramble to do some impromptu statements to fill up the time. Then a press conference, they held press a conference at lunch, and you know, my colleague Sonia Furstenow, our House leader, was flummoxed by the fact, or just floored by the fact, that Mary Polak, their House leader, released handwritten notes about a private meeting they'd had the day before, without actually running those notes through the people who were there. So, you know, Sonia obviously distanced herself from that, distanced herself from those notes. Then we had, we had the Liberal leader saying, the Speaker has to go, we'll put up one of our own. And as if somehow at this 11th hour, the legislature is going to trust the BC Liberals to do the right thing here, in light of the fact they've tried to politicize that position for so long. And then finally, watching at the end of the day as the statement was being read, as the Liberals walked out before the Lieutenant Governor came in, I just was shaking my head. It was kind of a mouth-dropping silence there, as people were respectful of their right to say these things, but just like shaking our heads as to what is going on.
The bizarre end of the session saw 37 BC Liberal MLAs take turns to read a script that denounced Plekis. Here are the voices of Mike DeYoung, Shirley Bond, Mary Polak, Andrew Wilkinson, Rich Coleman, and Joan Isaacs.
Member Abbotsford West.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I rise pursuant to Standing Order 26. Regrettably, I have become aware of behavior and conduct undertaken by the Speaker with respect to senior officers and employees of this Legislative Assembly that I believe
to be improper and compromises the ability of those officers to independently perform their duties.
I have further become aware of activities undertaken by the Speaker, including the seizure of records, including electronic records, that I believe constitute improper conduct
with respect to my rights as a member of this Assembly and impede my personal freedoms as a member of this Assembly.
Insofar as the Assembly serves as the presiding, or the Speaker serves as the presiding officer of this Assembly, I wish to disassociate myself for all purposes, including any subsequent litigation from these actions,
which I believe constitute a breach of the individual and collective privileges of this House.
And contempt for this House.
Penticton BC Liberal MLA Dan Ashton did not read the script. Instead, he directed his comments at the Premier and his own leader, as well as the Speaker.
To the government, and including the opposition, including the leader of the opposition, the leader of the government, and the leader of the third party, there's a power hanging over this House, the House of the people, and it has to be addressed. It has to be addressed now. We're leaving this place, the House of the people, and we're leaving it until October. And this will continue to haunt us.
Dan is an honorable person. And he, you know, there's, in all parties, there are really good people. On all parties, there are those who feel certain things rise above, their values rise above certain other things. I think you'll have to ask Dan why he chose it, but I respect him, and I'm sure his colleagues do as well. He showed the solidarity, but he took a much gentler, and frankly, I thought, more appropriate approach, which was to suggest that, you know, we have to move forward collectively to ensure that the legislature functions, and when we take actions that undermine the governance of the legislature, as we saw in the last 2 days of the sitting, this nobody benefits. So hats off to Dan Ashton for speaking probably what many were thinking, that there is a power and we need to fix it collectively.
While Ashton went off script, four MLAs were absent: Linda Larson, Marvin Hunt, Stephanie Cadieux, and John Martin. Cadieux and Martin have not replied to the breaker. Larson said she supported the rest of caucus but had an early flight. Hunt said he returned to the Lower Mainland to meet constituents. One of those that did read the script was Joan Isaacs, the Assistant Deputy Speaker, who was wearing her robes.
Member Coquitlam-Burke Mountain.
I rise pursuant to Standing Order 26 on a matter of personal privilege. I have become aware of behavior and conduct undertaken by the Speaker with respect to senior officers and employees of this Legislative Assembly.
No, there was shock on, certainly on the side of the NDP and Greens, which is the government side of the House, just shock that this shows disrespect for the office. You are an Assistant Deputy Speaker. That is a nonpartisan position. The role of the Speaker is to rise above the fray. The role of the Speaker is to ensure that we operate in a manner that allows for debates to move forward, that people have time to say their piece, etc. Wearing the robes to essentially say that you're distancing self from your office leaves only one question: why are you still in that office? And frankly, I don't see how she can continue to serve as Assistant Deputy Speaker in light of the fact she rose to essentially rebuke the Speaker's office, for which she is a representative. It was just bizarre. And you could hear the kind of rumblings at that moment. I mean, people listened respectively to the other Liberal MLAs say their piece. But there was some rumblings when she stood because of the fact that this was so unusual. Many couldn't believe that she would actually do that in her regalia.
And you've called for her to step back, and if she doesn't, then you're going to introduce a motion in October when the legislature returns.
I would hope she would do the right thing. This was the legislature must rise above the fray, and the Speaker's office must rise above those rising above the fray. It's a critical role. And to display that clear partisanship, and it's now the second time. The first time people, you know, this is when the she voted with opposition to voter conscience as opposed to follow protocol. Again, that was not, that broke precedent, and it's quite dangerous when you break precedent. But again, Ms. Isaacs is a very good person, and I'm sure that as a new MLA, she's put in a tough spot. I suspect that this is not something that she came up independently with, oh, I'm going to rise and say these words. I suspect she would probably put the words in front of her and told to read them. And I would suggest that whoever did that within the Liberal caucus should have a hard look at what their, you know, the level of disrespect that doing that did for the actual position of Speaker, Assistant Deputy Speaker, and Deputy Speaker.
The spring session happened under the cloud of the ongoing RCMP investigation into corruption after Speaker Daryl Plekis blew the whistle. Sergeant-at-Arms Gary Lenz remains suspended, an administrative review found Clerk Craig James committed misconduct, and he retired before he could be fired. The NDP government promised in the throne speech to bring the legislature under the Freedom of Information Law. That has not yet happened. Meanwhile, allegations arose that Freedom of Information Minister Ginny Sims was hiding her email from staff.
One of the issues that was raised as part of this all investigation into spending of within the administrative offices, there's a recognition that FOI, that there was no FOI for legislative expenses. I know that our position as a caucus is that we would like to push that to become more transparent. We're going to take the position that we're going to try do our best to reveal our caucus expenses proactively and make them public. As I did that with Vicky Huntington when we were both independent MLAs. It was a little more difficult when we had three to separate mine versus Adams versus Sonia's. So we'll try and do that starting from the new fiscal year, April the 1st, to do that proactively. And in an essence, to show that you can show leadership by putting this out. So I know there's an appetite within the Legislative Management Committee to make the legislative more transparent. The problem is that the behavior of the Liberal House leader through releasing private notes has largely undermined the trust that would exist within that committee. And I understood there was a good working relationship amongst the various House leaders on that committee in an attempt to try to advance better transparency rules. But I don't know how that's going to work forward because of the breaking of trust with releasing of private notes that had not gone through the others on the committee. It's very unfortunate situation we're in with the behaviors of the BC Liberals, because our legislature is founded in trust, and I don't know what they're thinking. It just seems that they're all over the place. I don't know what they're thinking. And with respect to Ginny Sims, again, I don't know the full story of what's going on there. There looks like, I've heard, like others, there's a disgruntled employee who has released documents. There's all sorts of threats of this, that, and the other. I would hope that ministers would follow the rules, and I don't know where this. I don't know that the final chapter of that story has finished. The one thing that concerned me about that was writing the letters of reference, but apparently these people were not on any watch list. So I don't know what to believe on that story anymore, because it seems to be changing fast and furious.
BC Liberal House Leader Mary Pollack breached the confidence of other members on the Legislative Assembly Management Committee after releasing handwritten notes from an informal meeting the night before the legislature closed. I asked Andrew Weaver if Pollack still has the trust of fellow MLAs.
That's a question that I think you should ask her or others on LAMPSE. I know that trust is something that you spend your lifetime building, and you can lose it overnight. I know from my colleague that she's very disappointed. I don't know how you rebuild trust when something like that happened. But that is an issue for the BC Liberals to deal with, and I would suggest they are the ones who elect their representatives. It's pretty clear that there will be trust is something that I'm not sure you can get back based on what happened.
During the spring session, the NDP and BC Liberal caucuses ran dueling ad campaigns that were paid by taxpayers. The caucuses refused to say how much they spent. The NDP had promised in its 2017 platform to end partisan government ads. The BC Liberals ran a campaign blaming the NDP for high gas prices, which are now lower than they were when the carbon tax rose.
Well, we get many, many emails coming our way, and it's pretty clear to me that a large number of British Columbians look to us as the official opposition, the three of us now. The behavior in question period on gas prices was just so cynical. Day after day after day, they're arguing that Mr. Horgan's 1 cent increase in the carbon tax somehow was the reason why gas prices went up 40 cents. So Mr. Horgan's response was, I think, appropriate, is that we don't control refinery margins. Let's take a look and see what is causing these prices. I would suggest that, you know, we know there's always a summer gas spike because of a switch in refinery types of fuels, et cetera. However, we've almost come to expect it. And I wonder to the extent that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that prices go up in the summer in this part of the world, much more so than elsewhere. We also know that in the fall, prices always go down. So there's going to look like mud on their face when prices drop back down, as they do every year after the summer driving season. This reminds me of the Axe the Tax campaign the NDP initiated in the lead up to the 2009 election, which they started in the peak of the summer driving season when the price of gas was very high. And lo and behold, in the fall, it dropped, and their Axe the Tax campaign fell flat on them because the price was going up and down by 40 cents or so, not because of any 1 cent from carbon tax, but because of normal summer winter market conditions. I'm not sure what they were thinking. I'm not sure who's advising them. I'm not sure who they think was going to actually, respond in a positive way to their question line of questioning. But I mean, that's a question for them. What were you thinking? How do you somehow think this is a good public policy to mislead people with respect to what's actually going on? I don't. And frankly, to do partisan advertising is just unacceptable. But, you know, I understand that government and opposition want to advertise the good work that they're doing, the good work in their mind they're doing. But when you personalize it and start going after leaders and individual, that is clearly partisan, and there's no place for that with public funds.
Andrew Weaver, the leader of the BC Greens and the member of the legislature for Oak Bay Gordon Head. The virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Jacqueline Wind and Dave Gilbert, who are setting out on a kayaking and hiking expedition on the coast of Vancouver Island to retrace the voyages of Spanish explorers from the late 18th century. It's called British Columbia, but Indigenous peoples have their own place names, and for a number of years, Spain showed interest in the west coast of what became Canada. So safe travels to Jacqueline and Dave. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo Bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of June 9th, 2019. I am Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on June 9th in 1934, 85 years ago, Disney's Donald Duck debuted in the cartoon Wise Little Hen? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.